Before we dive into today's trip down memory lane, a quick shout out to the fine folks at Remind Magazine, who help keep the nostalgia train rolling. This season, the Pop Culture Preservation Society is proudly sponsored by Remind, the publication that understands your collection of Tiger Beat magazines, TV guide issues, and random lunchboxes is not clutter, it's history. We love when Remind lands in our mailboxes, and we can enjoy that analog experience of flipping through its pages and reading all about the classic TV shows and movies and music and all of those pop culture treasures that made us who we are. And as an exclusive offer to PCPS listeners, you can get a full year of Remind magazine for just $12. That's 86% off the cover price. Just go to remindmagazine.com/pop. That's remindmagazine.com/POP. And you can take advantage of this incredible offer. Trust us, you will be so glad you did.
They created a very famous marionette burlesque show in the early 1960s called Les Poupées de Paris. And it featured topless celebrity caricatured marionette puppets.
Hello world, it's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the Big Wheel generation for whom Saturday morning was the holiest day of the week.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear, like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we're celebrating the Saturday morning legacy of two very twisted and profoundly creative puppeteers who left an indelible mark on television in the 1970s. Sid and Marty Croft and the Croft Super Show Universe.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists.
HR Puppet Stuff. Who's your friend when things get rough? HR Puppet Stuff.
Today's episode is a long time coming, because what may have faded from your memory, because it was brief and fleeting, was truly emblematic of a 70s childhood. It was at once psychedelic and for children. It featured giant puppet-like things, not unlike Grimace or Mayor McCheese. There was a faux glam rock band with the unfortunate initials KKK. There was Gomer Pyle as an alien from outer space, another faux band who could fly because they were bugs, a flute who could talk, another faux band made up of sea monsters, some enormous hats walking around on tiny feet, and an evil madman with a shrinking machine, two lady superheroes, a witch who was way too scary for children, and I only have to say this once to send shivers down the spines of every Gen Xer listening right now. Sleestacks. For me, the world of Sid and Marty Croft is anchored by Croft Super Show. But for others, that universe is anchored by HR Puffin Stuff. But suffice it to say, this world could only happen once in human history. And that was the 1970s.
Oh my God. Seriously, that whole decade, 100%. Fever dream. I feel like the entire Croft universe, that's like the mascot of the 1970s, right?
Literally. Right? Literally.
Because it encompasses basically everything of the 70s.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, really, what universe had as much impact on our television watching for Gen X than Croft, besides like Aaron Spelling? I mean, I think they are equal in their impact on our TV memories, really.
Because it was so singular. There was nobody else who was making live action TV shows with giant puppet things. It was only them. And even though each show was fleeting, but they would either go into reruns or there would be another show coming. So they were there constantly. And it doesn't translate to another era.
No, I was thinking this was not, these were not shows that I was like, kids, come on, let's sit down and watch HR Puffin Stuff. I'm not even sure if that was ever on VHS or anything, but any of these shows in the Croft universe, I did not gather my kids around to say, look, we need to sit down and relive this memory. Because like you said, it was unique to a specific time. And as we'll talk a little bit later, it might have creeped me out a little bit. You know, car crash thing. I can't look away, but gosh, this is weird.
Yeah, well, like some of those creatures might have been a little disturbing, but you can't look away.
And I think I'm the only one of the three of us here representing all of you listening who know about all these craft shows, and you certainly can maybe picture a lot of them in your mind, but you didn't watch them. And I don't know why. I mean, this was all right in my wheelhouse. I mean, I was like 5 and 6 and whatever. But after I did a little Google check of the network lineup for the 2 years that the Craft Super Show was on, it was up against the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour. Oh, and that was my jam. Like, I also wasn't really into live action as much as cartoons then, especially live action that might be scary in any way. Yeah,
this was scary adjacent, I mean, for sure.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Like, I preferred my terror to be in cartoon form.
And I
guess,
didn't
like,
have,
you know,
the
anvils, anvils dropping, running off cliffs.
Not scary at
I
all.
I needed that to be cartoons. But I do think that for those of you that are listening that might be thinking, I didn't watch, you know, all these shows. I didn't either, but I promise you, stay tuned, stick around, because this is so fun. This conversation, because it just encompasses, like we just said, our childhoods.
Yeah.
So even if you didn't watch it, I didn't watch a lot of these shows, but you're going to know about a lot of what we're talking about.
They are
for sure.
Visually rememberable. Memorable. That's the word. They're just memorable.
Wow. I think memorable is kind of a good one, too. I get it.
And that's a really good point about the cartoons, because I remember struggling with what to call these shows, because we got up on Saturday mornings for cartoons. It was a Saturday morning cartoon. And then we would watch the Craft Super Show cartoons. But I didn't have the word live action. So I remember struggling to, like, what's your favorite cartoon? Craft Super Show? Like, does that count? I was so confused by what I was supposed to call it. But I watched, in my rewatching, it's so funny. These are so, so twisted and weird. And they're basically like the shows you would put on in your backyard. The storylines are exactly the storylines that you would make up to put on in the backyard, and you would invite all of the parents, and they would clap politely and wait for it to be over, and like, there's a lot of running, there's a lot of hiding. Every villain has an accent. Every single villain is like, oh no, they've escaped again. Every, there are no villains that don't speak like that. And also, every villain is caught with a net. A net comes down out of the sky.
It's very like, what do we want to call that? Like, almost silent movie, you know, that early generation of movies, like the cop with, like, you guys do that great imitation of, like, you know, the
listeners,
like the Keystone, if you're watching. Yeah, the Keystone Cops kind of a thing.
But when you said a net comes down out of the sky. Yes. That is a stretch, Kristen. Annette is like dropped from like a stagehand who's like 2 feet above the villain and then just drops it.
And then they pretend to be caught in it. They just pretend.
But in the 70s, we believe this stuff. Yes. I mean, we talked a lot when we talked to Wesley Uhr about Land of the Lost and how scary, how terrified we all were. Now, when we go back and watch it, we see how almost ridiculously simplistic all the stuff is. But that also goes back to what I'm saying. And I did, of course, I watched Land of the Lost all the time. But of some of these other ones, you know, I didn't know about Dr. Shrinker. I didn't know about, you know, some of them. But it's because the villains, like you said, if it's Witchy Poo, if it's Dr. Shrinker, if it's a Sleestak, whatever, there's something about it being realistic, like an actual person, different than like the bad guy in Scooby-Doo that they're going to drop a net on.
That's true.
Like, to me, I was at that age where that was just too much for little Michelle.
It's too real.
As a person. Yeah.
Yeah. My introduction to the Craft world was H.R. Puffin stuff. And when I looked at the timing of this, it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. So this is 1969 when I was 4, okay? And my sister was born in April. And I'm thinking this is probably when TV becomes more of a babysitter for me. Mm-hmm. Because you know, my mom had just had me before, but now we've got Ronnie who has to be fed and all that. So plunk Carolyn in front of the TV and do that on a Saturday morning. Maybe mom is even sleeping in and dad poured me some alphabets and went back to bed. And so I'm watching HR Puffin stuff in real time. And that's every Saturday. And you guys, I had this epiphany. This is when my fear and disdain for anthropomorphic
oh my God.
Things
oh my God.
Came to life, because I was watching some old HR Puffin stuffs, and we'll talk a little bit later about, you know, plot and all of that. But needless to say, we've referred to this flute. There is a flute that's a good guy. The flute isn't even bad, but the flute has a mouth and eyes, and the flute talks. And it's like in Jimmy's, I think it's Jimmy's back pocket, and it has this really high voice, and like, Jimmy, what's up? And it's creepy. It is creepy.
It is creepy. Hell. It's so creepy.
It is so creepy. Yes. And there's a tree that talks, and there are things that should not be talking that are talking, and they're creepy, and I don't like it. And I had this just innate, this just feeling of, I don't know, I'm going to call it like Husker-Doo heebie-jeebies. It's just like I saw it. And I'm like, oh, remember? Oh, I remember. Like this feeling was inside.
Carolyn, this is huge because listeners, you have to understand that Carolyn is so skitterish. Skitterish is not a big enough word. Like when you have a monkey that is acting like a human, like the whole punchy thing, the whole punch, the monkey, like Carolyn was not on that train. She does not want to see animals doing human things.
Animals or things that aren't supposed to be people. So like a flute or a tree or an HR Puffin stuff. There's this vulture that's like, you know, Witchy Poo's co-pilot or whatever, and it's just creepy. No, you are you are a bird. You don't, and the fact that it's live action, so you I can kind of get away with it when it's animation, but when there are real people also involved and they're talking to the flute and the tree, no.
What you just said though about HR Puffin stuff basically being your babysitter makes so much sense, because my sister was obsessed with HR Puffin stuff.
Okay, yes. Same and
she's my twin. You guys are a month apart, and me and your sister are a month apart.
Yeah.
And I bet that's why. And then I have very vivid memories of watching HR Puffin stuff with her. But when I say vivid, I mean the type that I'm like, was that because I saw a picture of it? It's like, it is vivid because I remember that being a big part of our lives. But can I just show you guys, she loves HR Puffin stuff so much. I was texting with her yesterday and I was like, did you watch it real time or in reruns? And she says real time, because this picture is out in her house. And I've seen this picture my whole life. So this is from 1970. So I was a baby or whatever, and there, my mom is at Six Flags Over Texas. I was probably there in a stroller too, but look at.
Oh my God, with HR Puffin stuff.
Yeah, it's my, everybody, listeners, if you're not watching on YouTube, which I'm sure you're not, it's a picture of my mom and my sister, and there's HR Puffin stuff walking around Six Flags. But my sister was like, oh, hell yes, I watched it in real time, because this is one of my most cherished memories, is meeting HR Puffin stuff at Six Flags. So, but I bet it was because of that. I was born
in
March.
Yeah, and HR Puffin stuff was babysitting your sister.
And, you know, I was kind of today or last week years old when I realized he was a dragon. Like, ask your sister, did she know he was a dragon?
I did not.
I'm
raising my hand. I did not know he was a dragon.
It's really one of the first shows that maybe I watched regularly.
Yep.
And it was new every time, and I was kind of unsupervised. Like, seriously, I think maybe they made me a bowl of cereal, and because my sister had been awake during the night or whatever, like, went back to sleep, and my dad had worked, and, you know, whatever, and I was kind of alone watching this and the flute thing.
As I was watching last night, though, I did see what the appeal was, at least for me. I can understand where Carolyn's difficulty came through. However, for me, I think it was the combination of teens. A lot of the times, it was not children. Like, later on, it became shows for children were small children. And for me, that would have been like, I'm better than that.
Right.
I want to watch teenagers.
And when she was four.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Literally. I learned about life by watching teenagers at the beach on Croft Super Show. And so I think it's the teens plus the big puppet things plus like pretend technology. Like everything had a panel with a bunch of beeping lights on it. There's like an electro beam. There's always some button you can push to get rid of a mean guy. And then killer theme songs. And I think that together made this like just out of this world.
That's
important
true.
For this time period.
Yes. When you listen to like H.R. Puffin stuff, that was one of those. As soon as the theme song came on,
yeah,
I was singing it. And talk about like, you know, Hooskerdoon and all the things. I was like, I remember these words.
Once upon a summertime, just a dream from yesterday, a boy in his magic golden flute heard a boat from off the bay.
Come and play with me, Jimmy.
And I remembered the beginning, you know, the sequence, the opening credit or opening scene and all of
when
that.
When the boat comes.
In the boat.
Yes.
And then it changes and there's the storm. Yes. And
just so realistic. Yeah.
Yes, no. And then when he's going like up on the shore. Because there are parts of it where he's really running through a real life field, like outside.
Yes.
But then when he becomes like, you know, he comes ashore after swimming and it's on like paper mache rocks in this like little wading pool.
I love the paper mache rocks. You know, somebody just like picks them up with one hand and moves them to another place.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Carolyn, there are a lot of shows and sometimes it's very confusing because we don't know which shows are standalones, which ones are from Croft Super Show. When did we watch them? Can you give us a chronology of what we're even talking about here?
Yes, I would be happy to do that because, yes, it's very confusing. And also, yes, the internet is even confused. Okay, so I really had to do some really good investigative journalism that I did here. Like, I triple checked my sources. Okay.
Wow.
Don't believe everything on the internet and really not believe like that first AI little thing.
You know what I read yesterday? That 10% of AI answers are wrong, which means they said that's millions and millions of wrong answers every hour.
And you guys, you know, people take it as the Bible.
Yes.
And let me just tell you this little aside. I was so excited about this one fun fact I found. I thought I couldn't believe it. I like had to stop, get up and breathe a little bit.
Wow. Before. Oh, I can't wait.
I know. Well, I have to tell you. It wasn't real. It came up in the AI thing. So I thought, wouldn't it be fun if there was a John Sebastian link? And you're like, oh my gosh. So I put in John Sebastian Croft, Croft or whatever. First thing that comes up, John Sebastian wrote and recorded the theme song to the Croft Super Show. Again, I was like, exactly. Look at your faces.
Yes.
I was up. I was like, I couldn't believe it.
Oh my God.
Are you kidding me? So I write it down and I'm having all this fun with it. And then usually at the end of an AI thing, and listeners, this was just, I put it in Google, but now like AI is the first answer you get in Google.
I mean,
it's an
Google
AI
is,
generated.
Yeah. Google.
Yeah.
And
I mean, that's what
You've
it
been
is.
Doing that for, yeah.
Right. But so I clicked on like the source or whatever. You can click on that usually at the end of the facts that they say. And it was like pop culture today in pop culture history or something. And one thing was that John Sebastian had written and recorded the theme song to Welcome Back, Kotter. The second fact was the Croft Super Show like launched that day or whatever. So this day in pop culture history were these two facts right on top of each other. And they're not in paragraph form or anything, you know, it's just bulleted. So somehow AI took these first two bulleted facts and came up with the fact that John Sebastian wrote it. And I almost was going to put that out to the world. But no, people, because on PCPS, we do the deep dive. We're not just going to throw out whatever we find. And it was wrong.
I can't believe it's not true. I'll tell you who wrote that later.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So that's your little PSA for the day.
Yeah.
You know, don't believe everything you read. But you can believe a lot that we tell you, but don't believe everything we tell you. Okay. With that said, I'm going to give you a quick chronological timeline. That's probably redundant. You know what I mean? Of the Croft brothers and their introduction to us on our televisions. 1969, you guys, H.R. Puffin stuff, that was our beginning. That was our first introduction to them. And for me, obviously, first introduction to a Saturday morning appointment television. All right. Then we move along and we get 1970 and we get the Bugaloos. Then 1971, Lidsville. Sorry, I have a lot of facts here. Okay. 1971, Lidsville. And this was kind of fun. I always thought that the Croft brothers did the Banana Splits Adventure Hour. No, they didn't. They were not responsible for the creating of it, but they did help with the puppetry. So if you think that they
makes sense,
the Croft brothers were that they were a little bit, but that wasn't a show of their creation.
And Banana Splits was before H.R. Puffin stuff, right?
No, 1971 is when I get the Banana Splits Adventure Hour. Well, like I tried to do deep dives. That could have been on AI. I tried to triple and quadruple check, but I'm getting 71
okay.
for that. Okay, then 73 to 75, we've got Sigmund and the Sea Monsters on NBC. 1974 to 1976, we've got Land of the Lost on NBC. 1974, Far Out Space Nuts. 1975, The Lost Saucer. Then 1976 is when we get The Croft Super Show and Captain Cool and the Kongs on ABC.
Okay.
My favorite network, as everyone remembers. All right. So that has two seasons. So the shows that were part of The Croft Super Show in its inaugural season of 1976 were Electra Woman and Dyna Girl, Wonderbug, Dr. Shrinker, and they also ran some reruns of Lost Saucer. So we had had Lost Saucer as an independent standalone show, but then in the first season of Super Show, we get some reruns of that. Then we have a second season, 1979, of the Croft Super Show. We lose Electra Woman and Dyna Girl and Dr. Shrinker. We get Bigfoot and Wild Boy, and then later Magic Mongo. Okay. I don't remember any of those. Now, 1979, things change a little bit because we go now to the Croft Superstar Hour. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is one season long. We get Captain Cool and the Kongs for a little bit. They get replaced by the Bay City Rollers. And then the show is renamed the Bay City Rollers. And it's also cut to 30 minutes, so we're no longer an hour-long show. And we get these two new live action segments on this iteration of the Croft Super Universe, whatever. We get Horror Hotel and Lost Island. I don't recall those, but they sound creepy.
If you watch them, though, here's the thing. Like, a lot of people listening right now are like, I don't know Horror Hotel. I don't know the Lost Island. If you watch them, you'll be like, oh, yeah, that one.
Yes.
You'll know it.
And
you'll know
it's, and let's just say we'll talk about those later, but Carolyn would have had some fun moments watching those because we get a few of like, oh my gosh, look at where.
Yeah.
And then from 1978 to 1985, I thought this was interesting. NBC also ran other repeat Croft shows in an umbrella titled slot called Croft Superstars. So they kind of intermingled those. And so we were probably seeing reruns of shows and, you know, our younger siblings might have been introduced to some of these shows and characters a little bit later on.
See, this is so important because if you had asked me, I would have told you that every single one of those shows was on Croft Super Show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and so I would have too.
When they only listed Electrum and Dyna Girl and Wonderbug and Dr. Shrinker, I'm like, but where's Sigmund? I had no idea it was a standalone show.
Right. And I said Sigmund, didn't
I? Yeah,
and Sigmund came way earlier.
Yeah, way earlier.
Sigmund was no idea. 4 or 5 years earlier than the Croft Super Show. Yeah.
I was so interested in the fact that I thought Electra Woman and Dyna Girl was maybe a standalone show that went for 30 minutes, but they were like little 15-minute shows within the Croft Super Show. So you would maybe get a Dr. Shrinker and Electra Woman and Dyna Girl in the same episode with one of the, you know, Kongs or Captain Cool introducing the episode we were going to see.
Exactly.
So, this was really, it helped. Like, I felt very jumbled in my Croft knowledge. And now I have little file folders.
The whole thing was like a fever dream. And now it makes sense.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Fever dream is the best way, I think, to describe their larger than life, these surreal and psychedelic puppets that were so insane and bizarre and unforgettable. Like, for real, they still live rent free in all of our brains, right?
Yes.
I mean, my nightmare monsters all have big yellow football shaped heads and orange hair.
It's like a hamburger.
And a giant mouth. Even though HR was a nice guy. But what's interesting is that all of these puppets and all of the things you remember did not just appear out of thin air, even though almost all the ones we remember were the big foam suits, like you said, the Grimace, the whatever, with people inside. The Croft brothers actually started their career in puppetry by building marionettes.
Oh, my God.
But before we get there, we have to go back just a bit because they were both born in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. And I think this is so funny. For years, it was reported that they were the fifth generation of puppeteers in their family.
But they said in 2008, Sid and Marty said in 2008, that this story had been invented by a publicist in the 1940s.
Oh my God.
So for that many years, they just kept letting it go. But then anyway, their father, Peter, was actually a clock salesman who moved from Canada to Providence, Rhode Island, and then on to New York City. But here's what's actually true. And I know this to be true because, one, like you said, Carolyn, we're the Pop Culture Preservation Society. We report the facts. But I got this from their official website, sidandmartycroft.com. Peter Croft, that's clock salesman dad, he discovered that 7-year-old Sid, who was born on July 30th in 1929, had puppeteering talent, and he auditioned him in his own production of Snow White. I guess besides selling clocks, he was a producer, a director. Yeah. I don't know. We don't need to know. Peter put all of his efforts into training and promoting Sid. And when Sid was a teenager, he ran away and joined the circus.
Of course he did.
Is that not the biggest, like, 1936 cliche? Right.
And we didn't even know anyone
nets
actually
are falling
did it.
And then Keystone Cops play prominent roles.
No, he ran away. He joined the Ringling Brothers Circus sideshow, because, of course, this is like 1936, where he was billed as the world's youngest puppeteer. And then after a year, he was doing his marionettes. Well, after a year of being in the Ringling Brothers Circus sideshow, he moved on, and he was soon touring the world. He was actually opening for acts like Judy Garland and Liberace.
Oh my God.
You know, those really popular opening puppets.
With his marionettes?
Yes, with puppets.
When we say marionettes, I always make my fingers go.
Anyway, Sid wanted, he had big dreams, guys. He wanted to be more than just an opening act. He wanted a big, fantastic puppet show. And now this is where Marty, who was 8 years younger than Sid, comes in. He had been working with puppets off and on with Sid, helping him out at different things for years. But in the meantime, he'd been gaining a lot of experience in the business world. So they realized that what they needed to do for Sid's vision to become a reality was to have a company of their own. And their vision was to take puppets out of the realm of strictly children's entertainment. Well, mission accomplished, Croft Brothers, because like we've mentioned in a previous episode, they created a very famous marionette burlesque show in the early 1960s called Les Poupées de Paris.
Oh, I forgot about that. That's right.
The
we've
Dolls
talked about this.
Of Paris. Mm-hmm. The Dolls of Paris.
And it was racy,
and it featured topless celebrity caricatured marionette puppets in a very strange, very risque musical review. You know, I'm sorry. Can we just go back, though, that these puppets were topless.
Yes.
And they were like in a burlesque show. Now, I will say they're really beautiful. And in this month's Weekly Reader,
do they have nipples?
They're beautiful puppets. Yes. They're like three feet tall. And they're very intricately carved faces. And I remember when we talked about this before and I showed you all the picture, you were right. It's sort of like that madam type of puppet. But they're gorgeous. But anyway, it wasn't a joke. It was really popular because some of the actors who voiced these puppets were people like Gene Kelly, Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, Liberace, Jane Mansfield, Edie Adams, Milton Berle. It became so popular that they were asked to bring it to the 1962 World's Fair in Seattle. Well, then that was so popular that they brought the review to the 1964 World's Fair. You guys, World's Fair was such a big deal.
It was
a went to the 1964 Huge. World's Fair. I need to ask Lillian saw this.
Well, did she go? Well, listen to this. If she went to the 1968 World's Fair, she might remember this. So anyway, they brought the Les Poupées de Paris. You guys, I'm not kidding. I'm on day 90, my 90-day streak of Duolingo. I'm learning French this year. So, Kristen, you're about
Watch
to be
out.
Dethroned.
I can't say anything except mean.
Can you tell me what I can tell you that I have a key in my pocket? So,
I know that
my
there's
drop.
Something in my poche. There's a clay in my poche.
There's a clay.
Okay.
Uh-huh. But dans, what's in? Dans. Dans mon poche.
Dans mon poche. Ma poche.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. My clay. Don. Ma poche. Okay. It was so popular.
Don't touch my poche anymore.
Don't put keys in your pockets, folks, in France. Okay. So they brought that act to the World's Fair in New York. Then NBC approached them to design a family-friendly puppet show. They were like, no topless puppets, guys. A big attraction. This is now where Sid's original vision is coming to life, because they're like, we want a big, over-the-top, family-friendly puppet attraction for the 1968 Hemisphere. Carolyn, do you like the play on words?
My God.
Hemisphere World's Fair in San Antonio.
San Antonio. I have been to the Hemisphere, the tower and everything. Yes.
Yeah. And then this is what will change television history, because that is where H.R. Puffin Stuff was born. They created a friendly, large-headed dragon and named him Luther. And he was so popular, he became the Hemisphere's mascot.
Oh my gosh,
I did not
hugely,
know that.
The hugely popular puppet attraction was called Kaleidoscope, and it was in the Coca-Cola Pavilion. And it's basically the precursor to all the Kraft fantastical TV we know and love. Because, you know, they had all these different puppet characters. And so they basically reinvented their puppetry. They were among the first then to really utilize molded polyurethane foam and liquid latex to make these full-bodied suits, because they needed to be kind of lightweight. Mm-hmm. And then they could create really like massive bulbous shapes, like Puffin Stuff's biggest giant head, right? Or they used like polyurethane foam just for like the prosthetic for like Witchy Poo's chin.
Yeah.
So they were able to make big and small, you know.
So they
like
ditched the strings. The strings are gone, and now
pretty much, yeah.
And now it's really costumes. It's really foam and polyurethane costumes.
And inside of all of these costumes, it was actually really complex. As you know, on the outside is kind of not really simplistic. They're pretty amazing. But the inside was what was super complex, because there was all these like systems of moving mechanisms and cables and springs and levers so that the person who was inside could move, like, you know, open and close the mouth or that kind of stuff. But because the foam suits restricted the actor's vision
oh my God.
a lot and movement, they had to tell him to use highly exaggerated and theatrical body language. Like, for instance, if Puffin Stuff was surprised, he didn't just look up. He would have to shake his entire 7-foot body.
Yes.
And his giant foam tail would swing back and forth.
Yes. And it always seemed like the words were kind of disconnected from the, I was going to say the person, but the puppet. Instead, yeah, it would just be like arms flailing and looking around, but words coming out. But you're like, are they coming out of the person? I don't even know.
Yeah. And the mouth just kind of opens and closes like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and so speaking of Puffin Stuff, let's talk the most memorable puppet characters. I think for sure we're going to start with Sigmund, actually, because, you know, Sigmund was so cute. And I just loved all his seaweed. Yeah. I love how that looks. It all just is like it was very good, actually. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, he was clumsy. He was curious. He was easily frightened little sea monster who was kicked out of his home because he was too nice. But you guys know that the actor inside Sigmund, and listeners, just fast forward if you don't want your world to be shattered. But it was Billy Barty, who was also in so many of the Kraft World shows and so many other television shows, right? You can imagine that little person. He always kind of closed one eye.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
They meet him at the circus. He seemed like he would have been in a circus.
Yeah, probably.
I wonder.
Yeah, well, he was like Dr. Shrinker's sidekick,
yes,
too.
Right.
Yeah, he was a few things.
Well, then we have H.R. Puffin Stuff. I did not know that was only on for 17 episodes. But I said.
What? That was 17?
I know. We'll talk about that next episode. Okay. But also, you know, Puffin Stuff, born from, that's Luther the Dragon. And if you look at pictures, and I'll try to put some of those on social media this week, maybe just in stories, but see pictures of Luther the Dragon before it kind of then morphed into H.R. Puffin Stuff. It's really kind of remarkable. But like Kristen said earlier at the top of this episode, I don't think any of us can deny the most memorable of their creations were the Sleestaffs.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Right? I mean, we're going to talk a little. We've talked, you know, listen, go back to our great, like I said, conversation with Wesley Uhr, because he'll tell you about, you know, the actual basketball players that were in them, because they had to be like 6.5 feet tall or 7 feet tall. It was just, I mean, I think unlike, and also unlike previous Kraft giant puppets, the Sleestaks didn't talk.
No,
right?
They didn't.
They just communicated through that awful, oh my God, just that chilling, I don't know, it was like a hissing.
And their two fingers freaked me out.
Yes. Yeah. It was nightmare fuel. I tell you what.
Yes, there was a lot that was nightmare fuel. And that's to their credit.
Yeah, for sure. Well, also, you know, Carolyn gave you a list of all of the children's shows and the order. I just want to tell you, let's add to their legacy just for a hot second, because I had no idea about this. We all remember that they were responsible for creating, producing the Donnie and Marie show, the Brady Bunch Variety Hour. We've talked about those in previous episodes. But did you guys know in 1980, there was a primetime variety show that was very short-lived and apparently very infamously troubled? It was called Pink Lady.
Oh,
and
Jeff. I know it. I know it. Yes.
We talked about Pink that Lady. At some point.
And yes. Jeff, did we talk about it in variety
shows?
You
know who was one of the guests on there?
Who?
That had it. Greg Elligan.
Oh, he was on Pink Lady?
Yes. Oh, we have talked about it because Kristen knew about Pink Lady. Because it's a Japanese pop duo.
And they did not speak English.
I do remember talking about that.
They did not speak
English. That's right.
Why do you give a show to somebody who can't communicate?
And it was somebody and it was Pink Lady.
It was Pink Lady and Jeff and comedian Jeff Altman.
Did he have a puppet?
Because it was called Pink Lady and Jeff.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
It's so bizarre. Anyway, also from I remember this show, 1980 to 1982, Barbara Mandrell and the Mandrell Sisters.
Oh, the Barbara Mandrell show.
Yes, yeah. I loved that.
I totally watched that, even though I didn't really care for it. But I watched it because it was on.
At that time slot, I feel like when it was on, it was just you were always in front of the TV for some reason.
Hi, everybody. Let's pause here because I want to tell you about two books that we've been reading. As you know, the three of us are always on the lookout for books with nostalgic vibes. And we had two land on our desk this week from best-selling author of many other sexy, messy, sort of erotic suspense novels, Kate Stewart. It's a duology and they have to be read together. The first one is called Drive. That's out now. And the sequel, Reverse, is coming soon. So here's the funny part. The nostalgia we're talking about is the early 2000s. That's nostalgia now, people. And I'm really trying to wrap my head around it. So Drive follows a music journalist who's torn between two men. It's an angsty, steamy, rock star romance with a killer 2000s playlist. Okay, you had me at playlist, right? And the story will continue with Reverse. And in this one, the next generation uncovers secrets from the past and finds their own love story and their own playlist. The songs are important, and each chapter opens with a song that you'll remember and love. These books are for people who like Colleen Hoover, and they are spicy, you guys. They are sizzling, high spice. So if you're into sexy, spicy, dark rock star romances with a playlist, check them out. Drive is out now, and Reverse is coming soon.
Did you watch in 1984, did you watch Pryor's Place, which was a children's variety and educational show starring Richard Pryor, but it heavily featured Croft puppets?
Richard Pryor had a children's show?
Did you say it was shortly lived?
Pryor's Place. Well, it only says it's 1984, so yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Well,
this is all, I'm getting this information from SidAndMartyCroft.com, so let's just take that AI for what it's worth. I think it should be like pretty legit. And then from 1987 to 1989, it was something called the DC Follies, which was a syndicated political satire variety show.
Yeah.
And that was set in a Washington, D.C. bar, and that did feature life-sized caricature puppets of politicians.
Oh my God.
And celebrities. That was Sid and Marty Krupp.
It was super creepy. And it was and it was confusing because it was definitely for adults. And so I was like, I would have been an adult at the time, but I didn't know who it was for. And
but
also I didn't care
puppets.
About politics at the time.
Right.
Yeah. 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 So I mean, they really had their hand in so much. And you know what, you guys? One last thing is that, you know, we often kind of lovingly give these shows crap about, God, the sets and the, you know, the net dropping from 2 feet above them or whatever. But we cannot deny that they were pioneers. You guys, they were the first to really rely on blue screen technology, different than green screen technology, which basically is where they can, you know, like Dr. Shrinker and Land of the Lost, where they can kind of like shrink these, you know, characters down. Go back and watch it. Yes, as you know, technology has come so far since then, but let's not forget the time and the place. This was really kind of groundbreaking. They did that. They created these fantastical worlds using these really massive and highly stylized sound stages. we can look at H.R. Puffin stuff, like you said, Carolyn, and they're crawling up on this, you know, ridiculous little beach and this rock. But unlike before, this was all created in an enormous soundstage, and that hadn't been done before. And just the color palettes they were using were truly groundbreaking for the time, especially with H.R. Puffin stuff in 1969. Mm-hmm. And then Wesley Uhr spoke to this. I know I keep referring to this episode, but you guys listening, if you haven't listened to it, and it's from like 3.5 mm-hmm. years ago, it is such a fun conversation. He was the best guest. He was so fun. But he told us about this, the writing. The Crofts hired Hollywood's top creative minds to elevate the storytelling. So even if right now in 2026, or when we talk to him in 2023, we can go, that was those storylines were really deep. They brought in established comedy writers. They brought in legendary sitcom writers to ensure the human appealed to both children and adults. And they commissioned full orchestras to create these scores. And like you were talking about, Kristen, earlier, the theme songs, they were catchy. They were professionally produced pop songs. So as much as we look back and think this was all just like a silly fever dream, it was really all quite groundbreaking.
It was groundbreaking, and it left a mark. Like it almost doesn't matter if it's hokey or not, if we loved it. And if it left a visual reminder of what a decade is like, there were no other people doing it. It's not like people tried to copy them.
Right.
They couldn't. Right. They didn't have the innovation. They didn't have the creativity. They were the only ones. And the music that you spoke of, I do think that the puppets were the number one reason that people were watching. But I think one of the reasons that I love the Croft shows so much is because I have a soft spot in my heart for any show with a fake band in it, or a musical montage, or a sing-along theme song, like Hello, Partridge Family, right? And the Croft shows gave us not one, but myriad fake bands, so many fake bands, plus amazing theme songs and soundtracks. We could do a whole episode on just the music of the Croft TV shows, but we aren't. So this will be by no means comprehensive, just a taste of what role music played in the Croft universe. So just about every show had an important kid-friendly soundtrack or theme music. And by kid-friendly, I don't mean Barney, Plinky Plinky, nursery rhyme, dumbed-down music. This was mainstream pop music. And this is what we were given as children. And I think it's one reason that Gen Xers are into music in very profound ways, right? I mean, even there's this joke going around that Harry Styles gives out perimenopause remedies at his concerts. And that's not because it's music for old people. It's because there are so many Gen X moms going to Harry Styles concerts with their adult children. They're not taking them to the concert. They're like, let's go to Harry Styles.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right? Yeah, I want to go with you.
Didn't happen that often with previous generations. So I went to a library conference. So anyway, I'm saying thank you, Croft Brothers, because I think you were honoring us by giving us grown-up music in our children's shows. So I went to a library conference last year. I know, sounds like apropos of nothing, Kristen. Where are you going with this? And we were doing an imaginative exercise. They were leading us in an exercise that we would do with children in our libraries. It was like, I can't remember what it was. It was like building something with blocks or something like that. And while we worked silently, independently, the leader of the workshop turned on a song for us to work to. And I had no idea what the song was, but it made my heart hurt. I almost wanted to cry. I felt like I wanted to cry. So I asked her afterwards, what is the song that you were playing? And she looked about my age, right around my age, and she smiles at me like, you're going to know this song. And she said it was from H.R. Puffin Stuff. And she also said, it's not just me who is affected by this song. I mean, it was clearly making me get into the activity. She uses that song on purpose, not because it's nostalgic, because she's using it with children today. She says it lulls people into an imaginative state.
I want to know the song.
I know. I had to go find this song because I still couldn't recognize it. I didn't get Husker Dude. I didn't go, oh my God, that song. No, it was just something that—
It just gave you feelings.
It just gave me feelings, right. So I had to go find the song. And it was hard because all of the songs made me want to cry a little bit. They all had a very sunshiny but kind of melancholy vibe. So it could be this one. So this is when Jack Wilde aka Jimmy, on HR Puff and Stuff, when he finds Freddie the flute for the first time and he decides that they are friends because, you know, that's what you do when you pick up a flute. Okay, so this is a song called Friend in You.
I found a friend in you, one that surely will endure. Loneliness has just one cure.
Okay, so you get the idea. And Jack Wilde, as you can hear, he's very excited to find the talking flute because he was in a band, because they all are, because everybody was in a band on Saturday morning TV. Okay, so I think it was that song, but it could also have been this one. And I want you to listen to this voice and tell me if you recognize who this voice is. I'm going to tell you who it is.
When I was smaller and people were taller, I realized that I was different. I had a power that set me apart. I learned to take it, to use it, to make it. It's not so bad to be different, to do your own thing and do it with heart. Different is hard.
I love that message, too. That's what we grew up with.
Yes.
It's better to be different than the same.
Yes.
That's a whole thing. I know. Is that Helen Reddy?
No, it's not. Who is it, Carolyn? I could tell there was some recognition on your
face. Well, I think.
Or the Sesame Street lady.
Is it Mama Cat?
Yes, it is. You did it.
Because there's a movie. That's from the soundtrack of the film.
Yes.
HR Puff and Stuff. That's how successful.
There's a big difference, actually, between the movie soundtrack and the TV soundtrack. And the movie soundtrack is a lot more sophisticated than the TV show. And I would have told you, I never saw the movie. I don't recall going to the movie. But when you, again, just like those other shows I talked about at the top, when you look at these scenes, you know them. So I don't know if they were chopped up and put into other shows or...
And when I saw the album cover for the film, for the soundtrack for the film, I think I might have had the record.
Oh, my God.
It looked very familiar. And I've certainly seen clips of Mama Cass from that in her...
She played Witch Hazel. She played Witch Hazel. Yeah.
In her witchy-looking outfit.
I swear, even if you didn't go see this movie, you know these songs. They feel familiar. You know the scenes. Everything looks so familiar. Uh-huh. And part of the reason that you get these vibes is because the music for that movie was written by Charles Fox and Norman Gimbel, best known for all the Sunshine Pop TV theme songs like Love American Style, Love Boat, Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Wonder Woman, Angie, and more. That's just like, yes, they are the ones who did the HR Puff and Stuff soundtrack.
Okay, they might rival Mike Post.
They really do. And when I had never seen them labeled as Sunshine Pop before, but when I did, I was like, well, that explains everything. That's the sunshiny, melancholy feeling of 1969, 1970, 1971. And we have an episode for that.
Yes,
on Sunshine Pop. Kristen,
yes.
Do we have an episode for that?
We absolutely do. And it will explain everything about this genre of music that you didn't even know existed, but it gives me feelings.
Yes.
So even though these movie songs, they get me right here, right? The TV show was full of music, and no one will ever forget the theme song. Like you said, Carolyn, everyone knows this theme song, even if they've never seen this show. I don't know why it doesn't pop up on more best of lists, but we all know HR Puffin Stuff.
Puffin Stuff.
He's your friend when things get rough. HR Puffin Stuff. He can't do a little because he can't do enough. Whatever that means. I don't know.
Oh, well, I think that means if we go down the road of HR Puffin Stuff and we're puffing some stuff that you roll up, hand-rolled Puffin Stuff, HR, and also you can't do a little because you can't get enough. Like, once you start, Yeah, can't, there's and never going to be
say,
enough.
And they say addicted. Drugs had nothing to do with
right. I gotta wonder. I gotta wonder.
Because you remember they write to the adults and to the children.
Yes,
so it's like people can love the song and hear two different kind of messages. Because the episode I watched the other day, they the puppet things, whatever they were, are marching. They're on strike from this candy factory.
Oh, my God.
And it's, like, basically about war. I mean, some of the picket signs they're holding were, like, no candy, no war. And they're, anyway, it was very much a strike, and it seemed very much like they were protesting war.
That's
and,
very you know, adult. Those,
yes,
they're
exactly.
making some commentary. And I'm sorry, H.R. Puffin stuff can't come from nothing. It's yeah. got to mean, like, why H.R.? Why not J.R.?
Well,
J.R. is
originally,
a name.
I read that the Crofts early on said, well, this was Royal Highness. That's what the H.R.'s backwards. I think
backwards.
They just grabbed that out of thin air. It didn't make any
yeah,
sense.
It's why
not
would
like
you do
he
that?
Was a mayor. He wasn't a king. And I think they probably didn't feel like they could say the true reason mm-hmm. back then. But then many, many years later, I've read, not necessarily about that title, but that, yes, drugs might have influenced some of their,
okay. mm-hmm.
you know, whatever, influenced, whatever that means. But you can't tell me puffin stuff and then you can't do a little because
right.
you can't get enough. I mean, come on.
You know what's interesting is that they, speaking of all this, so they created H.R. Puffin Stuff to be a dragon.
Yeah.
Is this coming right on the heels of
Puff the Magic Dragon? Yes. When did that
yes.
come out?
I have that record still.
I have my Puff.
I have that
That's
album.
All the same time.
It is.
That has to be.
It has
yeah.
to be, yeah.
That was Peter, Paul, and Mommy. Peter, Paul, and Mary's album, Peter, yeah. Paul, and Mommy. Okay, so fun fact. Paul Simon actually has a writing credit on the H.R. Puffin Stuff theme song. Because he sued the Croft Brothers, saying that the melody was too much like the 59th Street bridge song. And you can hear it. H.R. Puffin Stuff, mm-hmm. slow down, you move too fast. It's
yeah.
the
yeah.
same. It's the same.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know. If you do the next line differently, are you still stealing? I don't know.
You know, that's...
Okay, the other theme song that nobody is ever going to forget is the bug loose, they're in the air and everywhere, flying high, flying loose, flying free as a summer breeze. Can't you see them like putting their arms through the air?
No,
because no,
I never watched
that.
Because they were bugs.
They
should have been singing or flying and talking.
I thought you were going to say Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
Oh, yeah. Let's just go there right now.
Yeah.
We have it in our opening every single episode.
Right. Yeah.
Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition. On the
That's
greatest
right.
adventure ever known? On the greatest?
Yeah.
On the greatest?
Well, just listen to our Wesley Year episode
yeah,
and you can
it.
Hear him
yes,
singing
Yes, that's true.
It.
He sings yeah. the whole thing. So the Bugaloos actually, so they were a fake band. They were Bugs, who were a fake band. And this was in 1970, and they actually released an album. The Bugaloos have an album, and their song For a Friend was a minor hit on the radio. It was, the Bugaloos are on the radio, you guys.
I love that. And it's about a friend.
It's
and
about
I just
friend.
Love this music.
There were so many
so
friends.
So nice and happy.
Yes. Okay, let's listen to For a Friend for a second.
Okay.
I'm not sure anybody will recognize it, but you will get a feel for what the music mm-hmm. was like on a Croft TV show. So good.
Oh, just bring back that kind of music, people.
I love it.
Okay, Kristen, I'm
so
giving
happy.
You an assignment
okay.
right now.
All right.
You're
going to
put a Spotify I won't say Spotify. You're going to put a playlist together of these songs so we can have a go-to place to listen to these happy songs. If you can find
them
on.
It's hard. A lot of these are not available on Spotify or Apple Music. And that's why I'm finding them on YouTube.
Yeah.
Because they're coming with clips or somebody has ripped it from a CD or ripped it from an album. Do you rip things from an album? I don't know. Whatever.
I don't know what you do.
Yeah. You can't find a lot of these songs. It's really, really sad. And that. It is. It's really sad because I love this music. Okay, so Bugaloos. Now that brings us to Sigmund and the Sea Monsters. The internet lies. The internet tells me that there was no band. There was no fake band on Sigmund and the Sea Monsters. That is a lie. Do not trust AI searches, people, because there was an episode called Monster Rock Revival, which is about Sigmund entering a contest, a songwriting contest, and he wins the songwriting contest. Yes, of course. Yeah. And he wins the songwriting contest.
Hand. Sorry.
But last year, his family of sea monsters were a family band, the Ooze family band, and Sigmund was their lead singer, and they won it last year. So this year, when he wants to enter it on his own, the Ooze family needs to kidnap him so that he can be the lead singer for their family band. See, AI, you're wrong. There is a family band. Okay, but just because there wasn't an official sea monster band does not mean that there wasn't lots of music in Sigmund and the Sea Monsters. In fact, there is a whole soundtrack. There is an album released in 1973 called Johnny Whitaker and Friends, music from the television series Sigmund and the Sea Monsters.
Yes, I see him in my head, like sitting on a rock.
Yes, yes, yes.
In the show, singing, maybe even playing a guitar.
Yes,
I don't
he
know.
Did fake guitar all the time. They did not give him any guidance on how to pretend to play a guitar. They should have, because it looks super fakey. But they were both.
We didn't know.
No, we didn't know. Johnny and Scott are singing all the time on the show. And the Ooze family, they have their own instruments too. So Johnny Whitaker. The album's called Johnny Whitaker and Friends. Johnny Whitaker, of course, is the child actor who played Johnny, who finds Sigmund on the beach and hides him in his clubhouse. Most of these songs on Johnny Whitaker and Friends and on the show were written by Bobby Hart, Wes Farrell, and Danny Jansen. These are the same songwriters for The Partridge Family, The Monkees, Bobby Sherman, but also Scooby-Doo, Josie and the Pussycats. Oh, and also, keep on singing, don't stop singing, you're going to be a star someday.
Okay.
Yes.
You're going to make a lot of people happy when they come to hear you play. Oh, my God.
I know. I know. Okay, do you want to hear a clip of that?
Bit of that, I'd like to teach the world to sing.
It does.
Yes, it does.
I'm surprised they get. Okay, I have a question.
See, more friends! We all can be friends!
Okay, I have a question.
Okay, a question. Carolyn, I'm calling on you.
Okay, this is one of these just popped into my head memories that I don't know if I made up or not, and I don't know if it would be on this album, and I don't know if it was ever on a Sigmund episode, but I have this distinct memory of Johnny Whitaker singing Seasons in the Sun. Is that a thing?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, I might have to look that up. I feel like it could have been on an episode of the show, but I don't know. Did I dream it?
Oh, please look that up.
But you were right, Michelle. There is a little bit, I'd like to buy the world a coat. Oh,
totally.
And keep it. Company? Keep it company.
Yeah, more than the new Seekers, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was about friends and everything, too. Gosh, no wonder my world is just, like, in such dissonance. Because this was my DNA, these songs that was like, we are friends and differences are celebrated.
We can be friends with a sea monster.
There's a flute.
Our
that's right.
Make
and
us
a talking flute.
Fun. Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Every single song is about friends. Every single one. So, but we're not done. We're not, there's, and I'm going to try and keep it short because there's a lot, but we got to get to Captain Cool and the Kongs. So when Croft Super Show was released in 1976, it was hosted by a pretend band called Captain Cool and the Kongs. That included Captain Cool, Super Chick, Nashville, Turkey, and Flatbush. And these songs were famously written by, Carolyn, do you know?
It's not John Sebastian.
No, but it's just as good, though.
Okay.
The Osmonds.
The Osmonds.
Yes. Yes. This is like prime Crazy Horse. It's not Bubblegum Osmonds. It's Crazy Horse Osmonds. And it has that same sort of Crazy Horse. Like when the Osmonds are like, no, we're rock and roll. That's what it sounds like. And Captain Cool, who is the lead singer, and he's sort of like the head of the show. He's like the host of the show. He is like if David Bowie and the Fonz had a baby.
Yes.
And it's very glam rock, and there's lots of glitter on their faces, glitter on their hair. They're very Croft. They're very visually outrageous. And so the songs are a little edgy. They're a little bit edgy. Thank you, Crazy Horse Osmonds. Okay, so here's the Croft Super Show theme, the one that played over the opening credits. And it's basically, when you watch the opening credits, it's Captain Cool and the Kongs as this band of, like, Pied Pipers leading a bunch of kids with balloons along a ditch down a highway. Yeah, they're, like, going down the highway.
There's a lot of things where there's bands and people, little kids.
That's so, it reminds me of the original openings of Sesame Street.
Yes, 100%.
Yes. It's like children following. They're like, come on.
Yeah.
And then they're like walking on the railroad tracks and they're behind a chain link fence. It seems very dangerous.
But also what I loved about it, and again, I probably watched that opening for the first time, you know, a couple days ago, but they're following someone who is dressed very differently and who looks very out of the norm.
It's very Jesus Christ, Godspelly. Godspelly.
It's very much like this person is okay. Like just because they look different doesn't mean, you know.
Just because he's kooky doesn't mean that I have to stay away from him.
No, different is good.
And they're leading the kids toward a gleaming downtown with skyscrapers on their way to what I now know is the world of Sid and Marty Croft Amusement Park, which is housed in what is now the CNN building in Atlanta. So now I can look and I'm like, oh, that's it. They're walking on the highway in Atlanta, which is weird.
That's scary.
It is. It's super scary. Okay, so here is the theme song. See if you can hear any Osmonds in there or any
crazy. But not John Sebastian.
Not John Sebastian.
He did not write this.
Sadly. Nope.
Sure.
Take a trip with us today.
So good.
We will lead you to a land of dreams. Got some super shows. They will blow your mind away. When you join us, you'll know why we say it's just a place in love where anything goes down. Where most of what I'm doing.
Croft Super Show.
Super Show.
Croft Super Show.
And get that in there.
So by the third season, like Carolyn said, they had ditched Captain Cool and the Kongs and replaced them with Angels Singing, the Bay City Rollers. And I was both confused by this and ecstatic because SATURDAY, night. It was awesome. It was so awesome. And now the music in the Croft Super Show was less theatrical musical interlude, like it was with the Kongs, with Glitter. And it was more American Bandstand, like with performances.
Variety show.
It was a variety show. Yeah. It was definitely a variety show. And it included screaming girls, which the Kongs did not. So now we have an audience of girls who are losing their minds over the Bay City Rollers. My God, watch the clip of a song they perform called My Lisa. If your name was Lisa, you are cooked because you'll be crying. You'll be crying and you'll be in love with these people, most of whom are dead. So now the show was about half music and half witchy poo. When is the Bay City Rollers? It's half
That's
music,
right.
half witchy poo.
Yes.
Yes. So yes. you got a Bay City Rollers song at the top. Then they might appear in the show. Then you got, like, actually in Horror Hotel, they might appear in the skits mm-hmm. with the actual shows. And then you got a mini concert at the end with, like, three songs. It was a lot. And I sent Michelle and Carolyn a clip of it wasn't a promo. I think it was a primetime special that was promoting yeah. this new Bay City, what they started to call the Bay City Rollers show after a period of time. And it was both nutty and beautiful. They were singing Jailhouse Rock with all the pompadours and all. They were basically like Sha-na-na.
Yeah.
And their special guests singing Jailhouse Rock with them with their own pompadours were Joe Namath, Eric Estrada, and Scott Baio.
There is no better time to be alive. There is no better time.
Yes, I agree. I agree.
The best is that then they're dressed up. Like,
yes.
they're dressed like 50s.
Like Bowser know. And Sha-na-na.
You guys, I still will stand by my early 80s addiction to Scott Baio's album.
Sure.
But good holy hell, what were record... You guys, he cannot sing.
No, he cannot. He cannot
sing. And I don't mind saying that now because yeah. we all know how I feel about present day Scott Baio. But back then, I thought he was a crooner. I mean, he was just, and when I saw that, it almost stops that whole clip cold.
Yes, it
his
does.
Voice coming out.
He's like, man, Jailhouse Rock.
The best is Billy Barty coming out with a big pompadour wig on.
Oh my God.
Dancing with his little person
in a poodle skirt. Yes.
And still doing the one eye thing.
Yes. He's got a giant pompadour. Billy Barty, like the pompadour is as big as his whole body.
We're putting it in this month's weekly reader.
Yeah.
We have to. And also, you know, as we're talking about this, you can see the evolution. Again, these Croft brothers are so smart because you think about the audience in that we're now the ones that have grown up with these shows. We're now of the age where we're going to scream at bands.
Yes.
But we're also not old enough to not be entranced when we see people from, because these live action segments have characters from the shows we grew up with.
Yep.
So when we see a Billy Barty or we see, I don't know who else would be on there, Johnny Whitaker, or mm-hmm. we see Sigmund come on, it's like we're little again, but we're also kind of crooning over these Bay City Rollers and Joe Namath and, you know, Scott Baio.
It's brilliant. I never put that together. You're right. That is so astute. And they
Thank
got
you.
Us.
Thank you. I'm astute, you guys. Kristen,
she's such
me
astute.
Okay, everybody, before we bring this episode to an end, I need to let you know that, as usual, I went down Carolyn's rabbit hole and I found some very interesting and slightly bizarre facts. You guys, there were some doozies, and we laughed so hard while we were talking about them that we decided to save those for a very special bonus just for our superstar and bicentennial level patrons over on Patreon. You guys, I'm not even kidding when I say that I haven't laughed this hard since the Dusty Bush conversation. You might remember that Dusty Bush convo, right? I mean, how could you forget it? So, if you'd like to hear us completely lose it over some truly bizarre rabbit hole facts, you need to head over to Patreon and join us at the superstar or bicentennial level. I promise you, it will be worth it. Okay, now, before I go down any other rabbit holes, I'm going to throw it back to Kristen to bring us home.
You guys, that is a lot. That's a lot of information we just poured on you. That's an awful lot. And we haven't even talked about the shows. This is why you will be joining us again next week. Because guess
That's
what?
Right.
We asked you, our listeners and our followers on social media, what was your favorite show from the Croft Super Show universe? And you let us know. And we did math. And we came up with a top 10 list. And so next week, you'll have to come back and join us for mm-hmm. the top 10 most popular Croft Super Show universe shows as voted by you. Thank mm-hmm. you very much.
That's right. And before we sign off, we want to give a massive shout out to our patrons over on Patreon. By supporting the Pop Culture Preservation Society, they aren't just helping keep the lights on, they're helping us archive the memories that shaped us. Their support keeps this time machine running. And today we're giving a special shout out to these patrons. Our two newest patrons, Tori, T-O-R-I-E, and Karen. Thank you Hi, so Tori much. And Karen, welcome to our fun family of patrons. We also want to thank Dana, Mary Beth, Kim, Lisa, Donovan, MP, Magdalena, Mike, Miriam, Linda, Diane, and Richard.
Thank you, everybody. In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast, courtesy of the cast of Three's Company. Two good times.
Two happy days.
Two little ass like the blue.
That was...
Oh, she's the flute. She's the flute.
She's Freddie the flute.
I was Freddie the flute.
That was pretty good.
Oh, that's so good. Cheers, everyone.
Cheers, cheers, cheers. The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.
Before we dive into today's trip down memory lane, a quick shout out to the fine folks at Remind Magazine, who help keep the nostalgia train rolling. This season, the Pop Culture Preservation Society is proudly sponsored by Remind, the publication that understands your collection of Tiger Beat magazines, TV guide issues, and random lunchboxes is not clutter, it's history. We love when Remind lands in our mailboxes, and we can enjoy that analog experience of flipping through its pages and reading all about the classic TV shows and movies and music and all of those pop culture treasures that made us who we are. And as an exclusive offer to PCPS listeners, you can get a full year of Remind magazine for just $12. That's 86% off the cover price. Just go to remindmagazine.com/pop. That's remindmagazine.com/POP. And you can take advantage of this incredible offer. Trust us, you will be so glad you did.